Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Bernard Laun, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, who discusses his recently published memoir that recounts his fight against the nuclear arms race of the 1980s and the danger we still face today. Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who summarizes her group's annual executive excess report and recommends how Congress can close tax loopholes benefiting America's wealthiest citizens. And Tom Pepper, Director of Operations with Common Ground Relief, who discusses the volunteer efforts in post-Katrina New Orleans that have filled the vacuum left by the ineffectiveness of some government programs. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Taliban, engaged in a mid-August offensive near Kabul, Afghanistan, killed one American and two Canadian aid workers and their driver. The three workers, employed by the New York-based International Rescue Committee, were building schools and training teachers in several areas of Afghanistan. After the incident, the IRC pulled its staff out of the country. Humanitarian workers in active conflict zones are no longer seen as neutral parties, but as agents of Western influence and values. As former aid worker Michael Kleinman wrote in a recent Los Angeles Times opinion article, many Western aid agencies have agendas such as support for women's rights that are at odds with religiously motivated insurgents such as the Taliban. In August, the Taliban launched a sophisticated series of surprise attacks against NATO forces that killed 10 French paratroopers, the largest number of NATO casualties from a single attack in 6 years. Insurgents have also launched a series of suicide attacks against a major American military base in Khost. In 2003, the Taliban attacked a Red Cross convoy, killing an aid worker. Last year, they kidnapped 20 South Korean missionaries, many of whom were released after a ransom payment. The U.S. subprime mortgage crisis has jumped across the Atlantic Ocean to Great Britain, where housing sales have plunged and foreclosures are skyrocketing. In June, the number of homes sold in Britain fell by almost 50% from the previous year, the lowest number since 2005. Meanwhile, potential English home buyers are facing a mortgage crunch as troubled banks tighten credit standards. The housing crisis has now spilled over into the overall UK economy as growth has slumped and the nation faces a possible recession. Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown is in deep political trouble. The dire economic conditions have prompted the Labour government to pump £3 billion British pounds into the troubled Northern Rock Bank to keep the mortgage lender afloat. Northern Rock was taken over by the government last spring after the bank suffered a massive run of customers withdrawing their funds. According to the Guardian newspaper, the foreclosure rate of mortgage loans issued by Northern Rock has tripled in the last year. Throughout American history, progressive social reform has come in bold strokes, with brief periods of swift reform followed by conservative reaction and gridlock. According to the American Prospect, progressive movements thrived during the post-Civil War Reconstruction period in dismantling slavery, in the progressive era in the early 20th century, with FDR's Depression-era New Deal and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Conservative reaction to the brief bursts of progressive reform have made Democrats, in recent years, reluctant to push for bold measures. Instead, they have sought consensus. After years of congressional gridlock, Lyndon Johnson used the shock over the assassination of John F. Kennedy to usher in a brief 22 months of major reform, pushing Congress to pass the War on Poverty, Medicare, and the historic Civil Rights Act. Jimmy Carter's post-Watergate era of reform lasted less than a year. His groundbreaking energy bill got stalled in the Senate as Carter's popularity faded with corruption allegations against loyalist Burt Lance. Barack Obama, the American Prospect says, should heed the lessons of successful reform by pushing hard and fast for universal health care, tax fairness, and other progressive policies if he should win the White House with a stronger Democratic congressional majority. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
When Ronald Reagan became president of the United States in 1980, his aggressive stance toward the Soviet Union quickly escalated the Cold War. Europe became the new battleground, where many feared that the deployment of new U.S. nuclear missiles and Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, program could trigger a war resulting in nuclear holocaust. Alarmed at this dangerous intensification of the Cold War, Dr. Bernard Laun, a professor of cardiology at Harvard University and inventor of the defibrillator, co-founded with Russian cardiologist Evgeny Chazov, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War in 1981. The American-Soviet anti-nuclear group recruited more than 150,000 doctors worldwide and put pressure on the two superpowers to pull back from the nuclear arms race. Doctors Laun and Chazov won the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts in 1985, despite active opposition from the U.S. government. Although the Cold War ended with the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991, rising tensions between Russia and the United States over NATO expansion, the U.S. anti-missile system planned for Eastern Europe, and the recent conflict in Georgia, some fear the world could see the rebirth of a new Russian-American arms race. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Laun about his recently published memoir, Prescription for Survival, A Doctor's Journey to End Nuclear Madness, in which he outlines the power of concerned citizens acting together and his view that the disease of militarism continues to persist in 2008.
Well, it's clearly an unpopular move for doctors to begin to act in a terrain which the establishment regarded as its very own. You know, politicians resent interlopers like us, but there was enormous suspicion that the Russians were going to use these naive doctors to advance their propaganda. We imagined that the Russian propaganda was so supreme, where in fact the Russians didn't hold a candle to the United States. In fact, we were attacked so vehemently as being tools of the Russians. Once when I was in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow with Carl Sagan, the astrophysicist and cosmologist and popularizer of science, the American ambassador, Arthur Hartman, quite angry, attacked me verbally, saying that I betrayed the democracy by scaring the bejesus out of the American people. For a moment, we got wide coverage in the media. But when the Nobel Prize came along, it's unbelievable that the U.S. Senate passed a resolution suggesting that the Nobel Prize revoke the Nobel Peace Award. NATO asked the same thing. Prime Minister Kohl of Germany appealed to the Nobel Committee to do the same. This is unprecedented. We doctors presented a threat to establishment values and outlooks. We may think of monarchs, dictators, presidents, generals, but ultimately it's people's voice that determines the flow of history. And if we can persuade enough people to understand the magnitude of the threat and the fact that we share the same little endangered planet, that we could bring about a dialogue that will lead to disarmament sooner or later.
I do have to ask you about your last chapter, which seems to relate to the present moment. The chapter's in the book is titled Communism to Terrorism. Tell us some of your thoughts about what you term the disease of militarism as you see it in 2008. And looking at this 2008 presidential election, what you see at stake for our country and the world?
Well, I think there's several problems with the militarization of our society. Firstly, it diverts enormous, colossal resources. The reason we have bad schooling, we have inadequate health care, we have cities that are at their core have enormous problems, infrastructure that is going awry, bridges that are collapsing. This all is because this is a zero-sum game. You cannot devote trillions of dollars. The Cold War cost us more than $11 trillion. You can't take this amount of money diverted to the military. That's the first thing. Secondly, militarization ultimately destroys democracy. Madison warned against it. Jefferson warned against it. And that's why the Founding Fathers gave the military a budget that had to be renewed every 3 years. There's a further reason. The reason is that world problems cannot be solved by military means. We ask about terrorism, but we don't ask why terrorism. You know, even a fellow like Napoleon Bonaparte realized, he says, do you know what astonished me most in the world? The inability of force to create anything. In the long run, the sword is always beaten by the spirit. And the point is, when you travel around the world, you see such enormous global problems that the military budget would have solved in an instant. A month of war in Iraq would help solve the AIDS crisis, the malaria crisis, the tuberculosis crisis. And the moment people are healthy, they have an investment in life, and they are not desperate jihadists. We think we can solve things by bombing, but in Afghanistan today, we're creating more and more opposition through so-called collateral damage. So, and in the United States today, we've gotten ourselves in such a fix that no politician can talk about this issue. When I see voting in Congress on the military budget, it reminds me of being in Moscow, the Supreme Soviet. Everybody votes for it. There's no opposition. If anybody speaks out in opposition about the Pentagon and its might and the fact that it controls foreign policy currently, that person cannot be reelected or elected. Something is very sick. And Americans are not addressing this issue, and politicians are scared out of it because the major part in the upcoming election will be if Obama can be the commander-in-chief. That's a ridiculous question. The issues in the world are not military. They are issues of disparity between North and South, poverty, and we have the resources in science and technology to feed all the hungry, to house the homeless, to provide health care. Why aren't we doing it?
That was Dr. Bernard Laun, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and author of Prescription for Survival, A Doctor's Journey to End Nuclear Madness. Visit the website of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War at ippnw.org. As the U.S. economy continues to suffer through the subprime mortgage crisis, high energy prices, rising unemployment, and a volatile stock market, consumer confidence is at a near record low. Apart from a bad economy, a steep rise in economic inequality over recent decades has seen the middle class lose ground. Stagnating wages, higher health care and education costs, combined with tax policies favoring the wealthy and a weakened labor movement, have contributed to a growing class divide in America. Last year, CEOs of large U.S. corporations averaged $10.5 million each in total compensation packages, 344 times the average rate of workers' pay. In a just-published report, the Institute for Policy Studies and United for a Fair Economy assert that U.S. taxpayers subsidize excessive executive salaries by more than $20 billion annually. This enormous subsidy benefiting the nation's wealthiest citizens is made possible by an assortment of tax loopholes and accounting tricks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Anderson, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and lead author of the annual Executive Excess Report, which she has worked on for the past 15 years. She summarizes the report and discusses recommendations for how Congress can close these many lucrative tax loopholes.
Well, we looked at five different tax loopholes that benefit top executives. And what we found is that if you add up the cost of all of these five loopholes, it comes to more than $20 billion per year in lost revenues. And so just to put that in perspective, $20 billion would be enough money to construct about 130,000 affordable homes. And so what we were trying to do with this report is show people that this problem of excessive executive compensation is not just symbolic, that we're actually subsidizing and encouraging these out-of-control pay packages, and that it's having a real cost on the rest of society.
What are some of the tax loopholes that these corporate executives and their companies use to avoid paying taxes?
Yeah, well, the one that your listeners might be familiar with is called the carried interest loophole. And this is the one that allows private investment fund managers to claim a good share of their compensation as capital gains, which cuts their tax rate from 35 to 15%. So a lot of people have pointed out, for example, that these, you know, gazillionaire private equity fund managers are actually paying a lower tax rate than their secretaries because of this tax loophole. And again, this isn't just a symbolic issue. We used actually congressional research that showed that that particular loophole comes to $2.7 billion in lost revenues every year.
Tell us just briefly, what's the prescription of your organization and United for a Fair Economy to reform these things? Is it just simply closing the loopholes, or is there other kinds of legislation that should be passed to take a more proactive approach to the whole problem?
Yeah, well, we think that plugging the tax loopholes is sort of step one. I mean, especially in troubled economic times like this, how can we allow our taxpayer dollars to be going into the pockets of wealthy executives? It just seems like a no-brainer to me that that's a problem that needs to be fixed. But there are other things that Congress could be doing. We are very much interested in looking at what's been done in Europe in terms of giving workers more of a say in corporate boards and really making the corporate governance more democratic and more representative of everyone who's affected by these large corporations. So that's another whole area that we think could be explored. But we have both presidential candidates out there really taking whacks at overpaid executives. I think they're putting a brighter spotlight on this issue than we've ever seen before in this country. And Barack Obama's been out there for quite a while talking about it. But even McCain recently has been speaking out, and he's been particularly tough on those mortgage lenders that have, you know, walked away with such massive payouts after really helping to create the bubble that caused the crash that we're dealing with now. And so they are out there rhetorically really taking on this issue. Both of them also would favor a reform that would give shareholders the right to vote every year on executive pay. And I think that would be, you know, a small step forward. It would bring a little bit more attention to the issue. But the thing is, it would be a non-binding kind of advisory vote. So I don't think we can really rely on that reform. And then when it comes to the more serious reforms, at least in my opinion, like closing these tax loopholes, Barack Obama has come out, like I said, to plug the one that benefits private investment managers, but he hasn't really taken a position on the other four that we raise in this report, and McCain has not supported any of the five that we address here.
One of the critical elements in you know, this problem of, you know, skyrocketing executive compensation and stagnating workers' wages is the fact that unions are so weak in this country. And I wonder, is a revival of unionization in this nation a necessary prerequisite to really level this playing field once again?
I absolutely think so. I think it is probably the most critical issue of our time to strengthen labor protections in this country. Unless we have some countervailing power to the elites, the ultra-rich in this country, I don't see a turning around. And there is momentum behind this bill that would make it easier to form unions and bargain collectively. I just think, you know, there's no coincidence that the level of unionization in this country has declined very rapidly at the same time that CEO pay has gone up very rapidly. The power is so concentrated now in the corner office in these corporations. It's concentrated in the hands of the CEO, with the workers having much lower levels of leverage and a voice in these workplaces. And unless we turn that around, I think we're going to continue to see so many of the social problems that we have.
That was Sarah Anderson, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and lead author of the annual Executive Excess Report. Contact IPS at area code 202-234-9382, or download a copy of the report from their website at ips-dc.org. August 28th marks the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's devastation of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, followed by a catastrophic government response at all levels where officials seemed indifferent and or incompetent to handle the disaster. Volunteers no doubt would have flooded the region in any case, eager to help in any way they could. But given the almost complete lack of government help, volunteers developed the only effective relief projects in the entire first year after Katrina. One of the first on the ground in New Orleans was a group called Common Ground Relief, which sprang up within hours after Katrina struck. Established by both locals and out-of-town activists, the group attracted hundreds of volunteers to reconstruct houses, provide residents legal help, and address basic health needs. As the recovery proceeded, Common Ground provided leadership in other areas as well. Fully a third of the city's pre-Katrina population of over 484,000 have still not been able to return home, although many of them would like to. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tom Pepper, a former volunteer with Common Ground Relief and now its director of operations. He described some of the group's programs, how the need for volunteers has evolved, and the more recent role of local, state, and federal government in helping people rebuild their lives or hindering that process.
We have a job training program that we just started. We're in a joint venture with a licensed general contractor here in New Orleans, and what we're doing is going ahead and training community members, paying them a stipend to have them trained in all of the building skills that are necessary for them to begin working to rebuild new homes in the community. We're hoping to go ahead and be able to form crews of about 20 each. And, I mean, I hope within the next 6 months to have at least two, if not three, crews working. And, you know, a crew can build a house every 6 weeks. So, you know, it would be great to be able to build 25 or 30 houses a year just with, you know, Common Ground Relief-trained crews. We also have a wetlands restoration program where we're planting grasses, cypress trees in the bayous of New Orleans that were greatly affected by the floodwaters and also by Hurricane Katrina. We also have a bioremediation and a community garden program. We're starting a compost co-op, and what we're doing is doing soil testing as people come back, you know, before they can borrow money from a federally insured institution. They need to make sure that their site is clean, so we're doing soil testing. And then once people get in, we're helping them go ahead and do the landscaping in their yards. We also have a legal clinic that we've had almost since the very beginning after, you know, Hurricane Katrina, where people had, you know, been arrested just because of the martial law that was set in place. But also, too, have been going ahead and doing quite a bit of work with the succession documents that people need in order to apply for their road home funds, but also going ahead and making sure that their lawns are cut, their houses are boarded up, and that their homes have been gutted so that they can't be seized by the city of New Orleans. We've been doing a lot of work with the FEMA trailer program, people getting extensions so that they can stay in their trailers because they haven't gotten their FEMA funds yet. Let's see, what else? And we also have a media outlet, a media concern. We have a weekly newspaper that we print for the community. And that's basically it. And then also, too, we still have scores of volunteers that are coming in who have some skilled labor capabilities who are, you know, hanging drywall and doing millwork and painting.
Tom Pepper, for a long time after Katrina, thousands of volunteers could be found working in both Louisiana and Mississippi. Now that we've hit the third anniversary of the hurricane, what's the volunteer pool like? Do you have a steady source?
Well, what we've done is gone ahead and we've partnered with a couple of universities, Marquette University and Occidental College in Los Angeles, send groups of volunteers down about three or four times a year. But what they've been doing is going ahead and training their students how to hang drywall. So we'll have a group of anywhere from, you know, 15 to maybe 40 that will come down for a week or 2 weeks, and during that time they do nothing but drywall the interior of houses. But then also, too, what we've done is gone ahead and reached out to schools across the country that have engineering and architectural programs and also construction management programs. And those students have been coming down also and you know, have been rebuilding houses and doing all sorts of things to do finish work. As the rebuilding effort has started, we really do need people who have some skills.
What can you say about the current roles of the federal, state, and local governments in the recovery or lack thereof?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a shame. I mean, the federal government has come in and they've, you know, put all this money in place and it brought some people in to go ahead and manage it. You know, for a long time it appeared that there was a lot of politics that was in play. I mean, Bobby Jindal, the new governor, has done quite a bit with the Louisiana Recovery Authority to go ahead and sort of, you know, break the dam and make sure that this money starts to flow to where it's most needed. But it's still a very long process. I mean, you know, the city of New Orleans itself could do so much more to be helpful. I mean, you know, they should be creating like satellite city halls throughout the city where people, you know, can come in on weekends and deal with inspectors and go down there and do their permit work and everything else. I mean, now everybody has to go downtown New Orleans to City Hall, which is only open like from Monday through Friday from like 9 to 4. And if you're still living in Houston or if you're still living in northern Louisiana or in Mississippi and you're sitting here trying to get your house rebuilt and you've got a full-time job and a family that you're trying to support, you know, to be able to come down here on the weekends, you know, you just can't do it.
That was Tom Pepper, Director of Operations with Common Ground Relief. To learn about volunteer opportunities, call the group at area code 504-304-9097 or visit their website at commongroundrelief.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.